and welcome to Cruisin' for a Reviewsin'. This week, it's another mini-sode, and I am joined once again by Liam, who reviewed Valkyrie with me way back in episode 5.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good, thank you. Thank you for coming back with me and doing another mini-sode. I never managed to release the last mini-sode because I stuffed up the audio because it was really early days. And I somehow hit the wrong button and I recorded something very, very different to what I would like to release. So yeah, in that mini-sode, we actually talked about our love of the Mission Impossible film series, which I decided would probably be better to release now anyway because I've actually reviewed all the movies from the Mission Impossible series. So yeah.
So I haven't had a chance to catch up on all the episodes yet, but did everybody that you reviewed them with love them as much as you did?
Yes, everyone was super, super into them. Like they all got 5 stars towards the end.
Okay.
From everyone, the later which ones, is, yep.
What about number 2?
So my sister and I did that one and we actually had a really good time doing it, even though the movie sucks, but it's very fun to watch with someone who's on the same page as you and just wants to yell at it the whole time.
Yeah.
So it was very fun.
Nice. Yeah, definitely probably the only bad one in the whole batch. Once again, like we talked about in the last one where it's after the first one, the Mission Impossible movies became about giving a director a chance to bring their own style to it. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a John Woo movie, but his style just does not vibe with what Mission Impossible should be. Even given the widest possible scope of what Mission Impossible could and should be, his style is definitely not it.
Definitely not.
Definitely just clashing all over the place there.
I also feel like his style of film, awesome in all the Hong Kong-based ones that he's done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's done some great movies. I don't like a lot of his American ones. I don't know. There's just an element to him that just doesn't like... I mean, I'm mostly thinking of Face Off, which I think is the worst movie ever made.
I love Face Off and Broken Arrow. The one that came before it is like his little testing ground as well for Face Off.
I actually really liked Broken Arrow.
Okay.
But Face Off, I think mostly because the casting was just appalling.
Right.
Like how to two fundamentally very different men. The only thing that sort of matched was that they had white skin, like they're both white men. I think otherwise just a mismatch of epic proportions. So
and
just that end scene where they're firing at each other in the church and like 10 million bullets and not one single bullet hits the other. Like, Jesus Christ. I can suspend my disbelief like to an extent, but Jesus Christ.
Yeah. The thing about John Woo movies and all kinds of gun movies is everyone needs to have like thugs because you need to have thugs that you can actually hit with. So obviously the villains always have thugs, but in that movie, the good guy, be it Cage or the other one, Travolta, never had any thugs. He didn't have anyone else that you could have the bad guys shoot. So the bad guys just have to shoot at one guy the whole time and then never ever hit him.
Yeah.
Which, just stretches that a little, just makes it a little bit annoying.
Speaking of thugs, something I was thinking about in watching all the Mission Impossible movies, and it's for any kind of spy movie, especially, and a lot of action movies, is thugs. Like, where do you hire thugs from?
Well, because I think you have to offer them a split of whatever you're going to end up winning, right? Like, it has to be, if you want the best level of thug, you really have to offer them a stake in the end goal. You can't just be paying them money. There's no real commitment to just like a salary, like minimum wage. You're not going to get a very good thug for minimum wage. You're going to need to, whatever your billionaire plan is, you're going to need to offer them a stake in the end goal.
Exactly, because why would you risk your life? Because they all die inevitably. They just topple off. In fact, it must be more than just a stake. They must be getting, I don't know, something significant, or they've got something held against them, or I don't know. Because I was thinking about that, especially in Fallout, like there were so many of I've forgotten his name, the White Widow's brother. They had so many men and they were just toppling out everywhere and getting shot and just so many. I'm like, is there like a Sikh sort of website that's just for the thugs?
And they have to know they're bad guys too. Like there's a thing going around about like the best bad guys are the ones who think they're actually the good guys and they've got a good reason behind what they're doing, which very rarely happens in the Mission Impossible movies. That these guys are more to the scenery bad guys than actual having an ethos bad guys. So all their thugs have to know they're on the wrong side here. So there has to be something pretty significant in it for them.
Yeah. Or they're just like, there's not much work going around and they're like, well, I'm good at thugging, so I guess I'll
The tradie lifestyle is not really working out for them.
Yeah. What is your favorite Mission Impossible movie?
So I knew you would ask, so I thought I'd go through and I'd try and rank them all. So I had a bit of an idea. I can't go past one. I love one. I know it's sort of the series as a whole has probably hit its stride in the last couple, but just as a way to introduce the series and just like Brian De Palma just at the top of his game, definitely like a bit of a director for hire to come in because it's not really his style of movie either, normally like a big budget AAA blockbuster sort of stuff. So to come in and just, it's probably the movie that's the most spycraft out of all of them. So that was even a thing that they talked about. I was looking up some stuff and they, when they asked a bunch of the people who were in the original TV series to come back, they were looking at the script and the script apparently was more action explosion-y sort of stuff rather than spies, and that's why they didn't like it, because it was supposed to be like spycraft and getting away with stuff and, you know, not necessarily having all the big gunfights and explosions. So yeah, I think the first one definitely I love the most.
I think when I rewatched that for the podcast, I always remembered it being very like, yes, very spy espionage kind of thing. And then it didn't have that much action, but then when I watched it like at the end when they're in the train in the tunnel and everything, I'm like, oh no, wait, there's a lot of action in this. But it is definitely the most espionage-y.
Yeah, because the first, so it's essentially three big set pieces and then a bit of connecting tissue between each one. And the first two are total spy things. Like they, you know, they're supposed to get away. There's no big gun scenes or anything. And then, yeah, you get to the last one and there's a big helicopter explosion. But even that is, there's no gunfight in it either. Like it's got the big helicopter explosion, but I don't think they're ever shooting guns at each other from memory. Like it's really just him trying to get across the top of the train.
No, I don't think Ethan Hunt fires a gun at all in the first movie.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. And then from then on, I mean, even then, I don't think he, like, he tries to avoid it. It's not very spy-like to be shooting guns at everyone if you can
avoid
it. And
then in the second one, he shoots guns at everybody all the time. And maybe that was,
just
was part of the problem. Yeah, just got guns, picking up guns from wherever they happen to sit and just firing with whoever he can see.
Just firing 1,000 bullets at gas tanks and Ford Falcons until they all explode.
The other thing about the second one that I thought was interesting was that it had a bit of slow-mo, like some of the fights and some of the running and stuff was slow-mo, which is obviously very John Woo. And that got me thinking that I don't think any of the other films have any slow-mo at all. Like they're all very, this is happening real time. This, what you're happening is what you're seeing. Like explosions fling people around, which you could, especially in some of the, in three, where they're having that fight on top of the bridge and there's sort of explosions happening and the explosions are throwing people over. You could definitely have forgiven someone for doing a bit of slow-mo. Maybe there is a bit of slow-mo where he leaps over the chasm in three.
Maybe, yeah.
But yeah, whatever it is, there's definitely nothing like it to the level that it was in two.
I think the closest they've come was in Fallout, where there was kind of a couple of dream sequences or kind of flash-forward kind of scenes where Ethan was imagining having to shoot cops to catch Solomon Lane.
Yep.
But that wasn't slow-mo so much as like they made it kind of more ethereal sort of feeling,
But I think definitely like if you the last three movies, if you're thinking of now as Tom Cruise, I do my own stunt, you know, showcases, is he's not going to want to put that in slow-mo. He's going to want to go, no, I did it in real time. So let's show it happening in real time to show what I can do.
And there's too much going on in the movies. Like slow-mo just slows it down. We haven't got time to wait around for things to slowly. So what's next? What's your next movie?
So after that, what have I got here? After that, I think Rogue Nation is probably slightly ahead of Fallout. So those two are quite close together as my number two and three spot. But I think Rogue Nation is just slightly ahead of it.
Okay.
I feel
the opposite.
Yeah, I know Fallout was the one that got you on this whole journey in the first place. Yeah, I had a reason why, but it doesn't spring to mind off the top of my head. I didn't love that they brought his wife character back into it. Because I thought that was probably the weakest part of three and the bit that really didn't fit any of the other parts at all was a very J.J. Abrams sort of invention, and then they had to push her off to the side because nobody else really wanted to work with what the repercussions of that would mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, like very narrow gap. Like they're both amazing, but I think it's just Rogue Nation slightly ahead of Fallout.
Yep, and how does 3 and 4 rank?
So from then it's 4. So I love the Brad Bird direction stuff. He's the perfect director for Tom Cruise, and I wish he'd stuck around and done some more because he directs cartoons and he directed this film like a cartoon, and Tom Cruise wants to do essentially be a cartoon character of like, I can do anything. I can be anything. I can throw myself off anything. I can bounce off anything. It's going to be fine. So it's like the Burj Khalifa scene, and then also that fight in the automated car park where just cars just come out of nowhere and the rules of physics don't really seem to apply at all because there's this thing going all over the place in all directions at all times. So I think Brad Bird did a really good job there. And then it's down to 3. So it's probably the next one down. So I'm my second least favorite, but still really good. Has the best villain. So Philip Seymour Hoffman, obviously the best villain in the whole piece all the way along. But just once again, J.J. Abrams. So it was his first live action film. I think it was his directorial debut.
Yes.
And he just has no unique directing style at all, really, for me. He's got his lens flare. So if you're looking for a J.J. Abrams film, it's got the lens flare. But other than that, he doesn't have any distinctive style, distinctive shots that he likes to do. It's really just, so you think of like the Star Trek movies that he's done and now the Star Wars ones as well. There's nothing that really makes them stand out from the other ones in the series.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, except that he does a lot of backpedaling and ruins.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, ruins franchises. Thanks for that. Thanks, JJ.
I'm trying to think of what my order would be. I struggle with this and it changes, but obviously Fallout.
Mm-hmm.
I would say probably then Ghost Protocol, mostly because the stunts in that, and obviously Brad Bird's an excellent director, but the stunts in that are just, like that building, I could watch that building scene 10 million times and never get bored. Then I think number three and Rogue Nation, I love them both for the stunts are really good, but there's just different things. I think I've tried to articulate this so many times. I think I liked three so much is because I watched it straight after watching number two. So immediately it was so much better.
this could be good again.
And I think also a huge part of it plays, I find Tom Cruise super attractive in that movie. And I think that plays a huge part.
He's got the nice shortcut on that in that movie.
Yeah, he's just looking so Tom Cruise-y. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I think that does play. I also like the gimmicks of them getting into the Vatican. I think that was just really, really fun. Yeah. And I don't know, Rogue Nation, like every time I watch it, I really enjoy it, but I never think of it that much compared to other ones. I don't know what it is. I think, Fallout maybe just blew it out the water for me. I don't know.
I think it's interesting because I think Fallout and Rogue Nation are quite similar in their style as well. So I think if you watched Rogue Nation before Fallout, even obviously storyline wise as well, seems like a continuation from Rogue Nation. But and then style wise, it's quite similar because it's got the same director, and this is now him basically going, yep, I've now got my guy who's going to direct all my movies for me. Mm-hmm. But I guess if you'd seen it the other way, then Fallout seems like the new one, and then Rogue Nation seems like the repeat of that style in a similar vein.
I think that is probably it. Yeah, because I definitely saw Fallout before I'd seen Rogue Nation. And then I always feel bad that number one so far down, but because it's an older movie, I kind of forget. Like it's really hard. It's like picking who's your favorite child, I guess.
Yeah.
Like obviously the number two doesn't really count. It's like.
Yeah. So that's always, I think number two is going to be at the bottom of everyone's list. And if anyone said one of the other ones was worse, I'd, some serious side eye would be going on there. I'd be like, do you really know what movies are and what makes them good? But that's okay.
I've had people say, oh no, I love that movie. And then they've rewatched it and gone, oh no, I get why you say all this.
Interestingly, I just had a thought. Jumping from number two to number three, so number two came out in 2000, and then three came out 6 years later. So it was there was that 6 year gap. J.J. Abrams brought back the Star Trek series, brought back Star Wars, and did this. And I think the common theme in all three of those is, I guess he doesn't try lots of really crazy things because it's almost like it's gonna be okay sort of style. So when he brought back Star Wars, the three before that were the three prequels, and everyone was like, oh God, it's, George Lucas, Ron and Mark, he can't direct, he doesn't know what he's doing, these were all terrible. And so his first Star Wars movie was very repetitive of what had made the Star Wars movies good in the first place, almost as a style of like, hey everyone, it's cool. People who know what they're doing are back in charge of Star Wars, this is going to be great.
Actually, that's a really good point because, I mean, I liked, is it Force Awakens, that one?
Yeah, yep.
Like, I liked it because it did feel familiar and everything, and then, on reflection, you're kind of like, oh, that didn't really do a lot.
Yeah.
Where then, obviously, what's the one after that? That Rian Johnson directed? Oh,
something, is it Rise of
the Jedi?
Last Jedi, that's it, yep.
Bloody amazing. And then he's like, oh, now we're going to take it back again. And like, no. So yeah, that's why it's such a letdown. It's like, no, we're going to take it back. I'm sorry that you didn't like our casting, the casting and all the fun stuff in that last movie. We'll just take it back to the beige version that you're comfortable with. Yeah.
So I think, with Star Trek, it can be this similar because they had the last generation movies and then next generation movies. And then the last one of those didn't get received very well. So then the first Star Trek movie back was kind of like, it's okay, everyone. People who know what they're doing and people who are going to be good at this are back in charge of this stuff. So I guess there's a similar vein with the Mission Impossible stuff as well. Even though it was only his first one, I think reassuring people that they weren't going down that John Woo path to keep it that sort of style was probably useful in terms of...
They probably had a lot of people drop off after two. Yeah. Like, I don't need to see that. So they probably needed people to be like, oh, no, this is just a good action movie kind of thing. A
couple of things. So you flagged Ghost Protocol as one of your favorites, but I had a couple of issues with that one.
Okay.
Which was, why was Hendrix such a good fighter?
Because we've talked about this, haven't we?
We have, yeah. This was one of the things we talked about the first time, is like, he's just this old professor dude. Why? It kind of made Tom Cruise, Ethan Hunt, look like, why can you not beat this guy really easily? Particularly when he had a thug, but that thug's obviously involved in a fight somewhere else. I thought that would be the big fight. But no, it turns out this Hendrix guy is actually like a really master fighter dude as well.
That's the one thing that disappoints me. Like, and the last scene is really good with the cars and everything, but you spend the whole time being like, hang on, who is this guy? Like,
yeah.
Why? Like, he's a great actor. And I was really sad to learn that he died like a few years ago. But just, yeah, it just didn't make sense that Ethan Hunt is like the best, you know, best fighter or whatever, spy in the world. Yeah. And Hendrix, who wasn't a spy, like he didn't even have a background.
Biology professor guy. Yeah, he was just like a future biology dude.
Whereas they kind of address that in number three with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like, he wasn't a fighter, but he just did gross, sneaky things to take advantage. And then when he had Ethan in a weakened state, then he could sort of try and bash him up.
Yeah. And then, so at the end of the Burj Khalifa scene, so it's revealed that the dude who they thought was the thug was actually Hendrix all along.
Yes.
And I have no idea why Hendrix went to that meeting disguised or why he revealed himself at the end of it.
So I worked that out.
Okay,
While we were reviewing that movie, that's something I didn't understand either. And then I figured it out. They were after Hendrix the whole time. So if Hendrix had gone as himself, he would have been busted and they would have just caught him, and then they've got their man. So he had to send his second hand man. You know, they're like, we need him to get to Hendrix. And the only reason I can think of that Hendrix went is because he's an egomaniac who just had to one up.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. It's not a good a good theory, but I think that's what it is. I think the reason why he went in a mask is because he must have known that there's a chance that the IMF were going to try and intercept them or something.
Yeah.
And he was just the kind of guy who couldn't resist being there to do it himself. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely the way the movie played the reveal, it was supposed to be like, oh my God, that's a big shocking moment. Or even like, he has mass technology as well, so somehow he's tied into the IMF or something like that as well. But then they really never address it.
Yes. I think they took a little while to really get their stride with the mask reveals, because like in number two, it's just like constantly 10,000 masks.
Yeah.
Just flying off everywhere, like a backpack full of masks just at all times. And yeah, there's a few where you're like, did that need to be a mask? Yeah, by the Rogue Nation, I think they kind of figured out just a subtle little, oh crap, it was a mask all along kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think they probably nailed it the most in the first movie, like at the end where John Voight is Ethan Hunt the whole time. You're like, that was the perfect use of the mask.
Mm. Yeah, it was cool.
And then again in Fallout when Benji is Solomon Lane. Very good.
Mm. Yeah, that was cool as well. Yeah, like they use it, I guess they don't make it a huge crux point in the plot the way they did in the first couple. Like, it sort of tends to be like a little segment off to the side where something happens and it's related to a mask, and then like the big reveal doesn't necessarily shift the whole movie all the way. Although, I mean, even the Solomon Lane one kind of does, because that's where everybody figures out that it was that Henry Cavill's character was the bad guy. So, yeah.
Yes. So in my last minisode I did after Fallout, we talked about what we think the future of the Mission Impossible franchise is. We won't go over too much, but do you have any thoughts of what the next two movies might be?
I hate to say it, but at some point he has to start. So I thought after Ghost Protocol that they were building for Jeremy Renner to come in and take over the franchise. And
please
I
don't.
Think it, no, which in like at the time, because at the time I think he was a really, at the time I remember thinking he was a really cool guy and probably a good person to take it over. He could be like, not, you know, he doesn't do all his own stunt sort of stuff, but yeah, still keeping in that action thing. He was also right in the middle of all the MCU stuff as well. So he was the guy, and that's right, because he was in the Bourne franchise as well. So he was basically the guy who was being groomed to take over all the franchises everywhere. I don't think he's that much younger than Tom Cruise though. So it was interesting that it felt like he was being groomed to take it over, but probably still had the same shelf life as Tom, if not a little less. But I think at some point Tom has to start finding who's going to take this franchise over or work with him like on the next two movies or three movies, like a young sort of 25 to 30 year old. And it could be a woman. It'd be great if it was a woman. Mm-hmm. But I think they need to find who's going to run that franchise, with Tom continuing to do the producing and being really involved with it along the way.
Yeah, I don't think Tom Cruise, as great as he is, I don't think he can continue being Ethan Hunt into his like late 60s.
Mm. Yeah, at some point.
That's a big call.
Yeah. So that's really the only thought that I've had. Like, yeah, just keeping it on the spy. Like, the idea of the agency behind them seems to change a lot. Like, they just change it to whatever it needs to be. So in three, it's like this really huge thing with lots of agents out there. And then after a certain point, it's no, it's just him. And then after that, it's back to being a huge agency with lots of people and stuff like that. So I don't know whether they need, or if they even want any stability with that. It was interesting because I think with the TV series, they didn't really talk about the agency that much. Like, it was really just he would get his instructions instructions from some mysterious figure, and then like they didn't interact with the actual agency itself that much. So I don't know where they want to go back to that.
I think in memory, all the people who were the IMF were actually private citizens who did stuff for like the CIA. So they were like, I think, wasn't the main guy, he was like some wealthy businessman or something. And so they dabbled in being spies like for hire kind of thing. So they didn't actually have an agency. It was just like a group of people being like, yeah, we'll go do that for you.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know what they need to, or they just keep using it as they want to.
Do you think this is, there's going to be more movies like with or without Tom Cruise?
I think so. I think yeah, Tom Cruise, I mean, because he produces them all as well. And he and Christopher McQuarrie write them all as well. So I definitely think there's a space there for him to just keep doing that. Even if he's not, and still having a role in it as well, even if it's not the central role, whether that's something he's interested in, or if he just steps away from the acting side of it altogether and just does the production. But he's produced all six movies so far, and he's producing 7 and 8, so it's obviously something that he loves, and they keep making money, so the studios are going to keep liking them so long as they're, you know, making money. So I think they'll keep going.
I wonder if they do try and make a new Ethan Hunt kind of thing, if that's where people will be like, okay, I'm done with that series now. Like,
I think it's going to have to be someone who looks the part. So I saw I watched the new Charlie's Angels movie the other day, and that's got a lot. It's got the three women in it, and they do a lot of fighting, but you can tell that two of them weren't trained for fighting. Like, they've done the bare minimum of training to get into the movie role, but they're not lifelong people who've done that sort of stuff. And you can always tell with action movies of when they've got people in them who haven't been action stars or been martial arts people or fighting people their whole lives. It's like they've just done the bare minimum of training to get into that point. So I think if that's what they need to find, someone who's going to pick up the mantle, it needs to be someone who's going to look good enough and look like they know what they're doing all the way through.
Did you say one of them looked like they?
Yeah, I can't remember her name. There was the British lady from the MI6, and even in the reviews, they said like when she was fighting, the camera could cut back and just have long cuts with her just doing the fighting. Whereas when it was the other two, it was quite close up, and there would be short, so you just get the shot of the punch going in or them spinning the 180 or whatever.
Okay.
There's definitely different ways that they shoot things when you've got someone who looks like they know what they're doing versus someone someone who does know what they're doing versus someone who's just done that minimum of training to get into a certain point.
I just had a thought of someone who, if they were to continue on with doing Mission Impossible movies and they needed a new Ethan Hunt, someone who's not only a woman but is a non-white person. I just did a big Facebook post about it. Was it Mortal Engines? I just watched the Mortal Engines movie.
Okay. And I haven't seen that, but it's on my list.
So yeah, there was a character in the movie called Jihei. She's actually a South Korean singer her name is Jihei. She played a character called Anna Fang. And yeah, she's a Korean woman. And her presence on screen was the best I've ever seen an actor in my entire life.
Nice.
Like, she was just the most charismatic. She had the coolest outfits and coolest hair and everything. I think she actually knows some martial arts.
Yeah.
So yeah, just amazing. So now that I'm thinking about that, if anyone's going to replace Ethan Hunt, I would petition and do whatever I could in my power to make sure that was her, because
awesome.
That's what we need. We need someone really charismatic and cool and interesting, which is why I guess they've always sort of stuck with the same sort of style of people for James Bond.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to deviate too much.
Which they really should. Will freak out.
Yeah.
Small man children will freak out.
Yeah. I mean, Daniel Craig's great, but he can't do that forever.
I think the one he's done now is his last one, isn't it? I mean, I think he said that after Spectre.
I think he said that after the last two.
But yeah, I think it's time for another one there as well. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they could just get someone who's just got a very different energy to it.
Yeah. I would like to think that Mission Impossible will continue, because it is a universe that doesn't need, like, you can just follow completely different characters. You don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go by the thing where there's, you know, it's a fairly big agency and there's lots of different teams. I mean, obviously there's lots of different things to spy on at all times in the world. So
yeah,
it could be like a really cool shared universe. And that's where Ethan Hunt could just kind of pop up as like little cameos as they sort of intersect during their missions and stuff.
He could even start being the voice of the person that gives out the missions as well.
Mm.
So he could be like the headquarter dude who's just handing that stuff out.
That's true.
Speaking of handing out missions, the other thing that number two is terrible at is, like, I love Anthony Hopkins, but there's just no reason for him to be in that movie at all. And that the first time where he meets up is like, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to come and meet me and then I'll give you your real mission. It's like, what the hell is that? That's just nonsense.
And also, when he met up with him, he was just being a big sexist pig about how Andy Newton's character had to be used, and how, like, if this is what women are good for, being deceitful bitches. And I'm like, excuse me. It was so rough. Yeah,
I think you could have used it as like used his voice when he gives him the first mission. And then if you want to use him and put him in the movie, you could have him at the end the way they did anyway. But yeah, just to have it be, you have to come and find me. It's like, what? I don't. Yeah. It almost felt like just a different. I mean, it's the same thing. It probably could have been like just a different movie that they just shoehorned the Mission Impossible stuff into. They just found a script that they liked, a spy movie or an action movie, and then just shoehorned the Mission Impossible stuff into it. And then where it didn't work, they were just like, ah, we don't care that much.
Yeah, I kind of, now I'm thinking about it, maybe they'll go a bit like the Fast and the Furious franchise, where they're now like branching off and, you know, different characters are going different ways. And yeah, how exciting. Before we wrap up, I would like to know from you, what is your all-time favorite stunt from all the Mission Impossible movies?
So I've actually done a top three as well, because I remember you asked me that last time as well.
Excellent.
So in spot number three is the airplane stunt from the start of Rogue Nation, which I just, like, that's on YouTube, and I, like, I'm pretty sure I watch that every couple of weeks. It's just, it's not a big fight scene, which is the other thing that I love. Like, it is a very spy sort of thing. Like, they're almost trying to get away without the people knowing that they've stolen it back, although that doesn't really work out in the end. But there's no big punching, there's no guns or anything like that. It's just people trying to break into a thing, and then obviously him holding onto the side of the plane is just amazing, and I love it.
And just, I reiterate to people constantly, like, Tom Cruise hung onto the side of a plane with a couple of cords keeping him attached. Like, everyone would have been shitting themselves, rightfully so. And I just cannot believe people were just like, I guess they can't say no to Tom Cruise. They're just like, okay, just let him do it.
The insurance payout, the insurance thing is all there. But, and like that whole thing where he's on the plane as well, like, it's a really long shot as well. So that's backs up what we were saying before, is like, if someone's actually doing something, you can put a long shot of them doing it. It's only if they're not really doing it that you need to keep cutting it really quickly. And then, so number two is just the Burj Khalifa scene, the whole scene with the building. I've got a problem with heights, so it just freaks me out every time, and when things start failing, and where he jumps, so where he lets go of the rope at the very end and jumps to the window, and the other two have to leap out the window to try to catch him as well. And it just, it almost happens really quickly as well, so you don't have a lot of time to mentally prepare yourself. You're like, oh, okay, so he's gonna fling himself off the rope and try and go through the window. Oh no, he's done it already. So I know a lot of movies as well, they build up to something like that. They'd have like lots of really sort of the swelling music, and they'd be pausing, he'd be looking down and looking back and all that sort of stuff, and this time he looks down and goes, oh, this is what I have to do to get over there, and time's a thing, so I'm gonna just fling myself over there, and good luck to me.
And then even just being near that window in that scene, like filming that, I would have thrown up about 100 times, I think.
I would not be able to be in the building above a certain floor. Like, I'd have to just stay in the hallway instead. And then for my number one, can't go past the CIA robbery in Mission Impossible 1, the one that set it all off, the whole thing, like, you know, generated 1,000 memes of people falling and people struggling and, you know, holding on to points and that sort of stuff. So just the cool action scene, and just that precise timing that Brian De Palma brings to it, of like, you know, they disappear just as the guy comes back in, and the sound stuff kicks off just as the guy's coming through it. So yeah, just the extra little pieces all the way through it are really cool.
They're really good, really good picks. I don't know what mine are. I would say on top of those, because they all three of the best ones ever, I also have a very big soft spot for, I really like the underwater scene in Rogue Nation, where just knowing, I mean, he's not holding his breath the entire time because there's lots of shots, but knowing that he could have done that because he can hold his breath for 6 minutes just blows my mind all the time. And in Fallout, if I had to pick, I can't. It would either be the car chase. I don't know if it's a motorbike chase through Paris or the car chase through Paris. Because both are just, I just love a good car chase through a European city. And just, some of the stunts he does in that little green BMW, they say in the making of, even seasoned stunt people would struggle with, and Tom Cruise just fucking blasts through it. But I would say probably the helicopter scene.
Yep.
Is probably, well, the Halo jump. Oh my God, I could just talk about Fallout for another half an hour. So there's too many stunts in that movie where you're just like, they're all so dangerous and they're all so cool.
Yeah.
And it's obnoxious that that movie was so new and refreshing and fun, even though it's number six.
Yeah, because underwater stuff freaks me out a little bit. And I like it. Yeah, the idea of drowning is one of my sort of things that I don't like. So I don't like the idea of being on a submarine, or even being on a boat sort of tends to freak me out a little bit. So yeah, the underwater stuff in that one, in Rogue Nation, gave me the heebie-jeebies. And then same with the Halo stuff from the Fallout as well. And I think the beauty of that one was there'd been stuff that was in the trailers. So I hate it when movies give away all their cool pieces in the trailers.
Oh, yeah. I've stopped watching trailers now, actually, for a lot of movies.
Yeah. Some of them I'll watch the first one. And if I go, yep, I'm watching that movie, then I'll just go, all right, that's it. I'm not going to see any more trailers. Yeah. But yeah, the Halo one, there was nothing in any of the trailers about any of that stuff. And I think they could have made a really cool trailer because they use so much of it. A lot of the cool thing about that scene is how silent it is. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't, you know, it's not them screaming, or like you can really hear those noises and everything is so carefully controlled. I think they could have made a really cool trailer out of that, building up that suspense as they come through. But they just cut it out. They didn't use any of it in the trailer, which meant it was a real surprise.
Actually, a lot of the stuff in the Fallout trailer didn't even get used. Like, it was about three stunts in it. Cut them out.
So I think one of the ones that I really missed was where they were, like, after they land the Halo stuff, and there's a shot in the nightclub in the trailer of him, like, flying from, like, on a piece of rope, like, almost across. Trapezing. Yeah.
Yep.
And like, doing something in there while he's doing it. And then, yeah, that never happens, which is really disappointing, because I was like, that would have been really cool.
If you look at the making of, they do... the behind the scenes, they show that Christopher McQuarrie doesn't like sharing the deleted scenes and stuff, because he's like, the movie I'm releasing is the movie I want everyone to see. He doesn't believe in director's cuts necessarily, but he's like, that one, as it was such a cool stunt, I'm gonna let you see it because it just didn't need to be there, but it still was a really sick stunt. So
He's a really cool guy to follow on Twitter as well. If you don't follow him on Twitter, he does Q&A's quite regularly, and that's his tone and his approach on Twitter as well. Is like, people say, what's a thing you wish you could have included in a movie, and he just goes, no, the movie was what it was. I made the movie, I wrote it, what you saw is what the movie was. The other bits, if I cut a bit out, it's because it didn't belong, so I'm not going to tell you about the bits that didn't belong.
This is fair enough. I mean, I would watch 600 more hours of lost footage of Fallout, but if he doesn't want to give it to me, fine.
we need like a 20 minute version of that fight scene in the bathroom where they just beating the shit out of each other for like 20 minutes, just on and on, just destroy the bathroom altogether.
That's another amazing, I mean, it's not really stunty, but an incredible
scene. It counts, yeah.
And just that guy playing John Lark, my God, what a fighter.
Yeah. we should, try and get him in more stuff. I'd have to look up who he is and see if he can be in more stuff.
He's a famous stunt actor, and he did stunts in The Last Jedi, I think. He's done lots of really good stunts in some really good movies, but this is the first time he's properly been an actual actor. He was meant to just be the stunt actor for whoever John Lark was going to be, and they're like, let's just make him John Lark. Whatever, who cares?
And I think that's the thing as well. Like, you bring in someone like that to play a short role versus they could have had that be someone well known. They could have had someone come in for almost like a cameo 10-minute role and then train them up in how to be a fighter. But then it wouldn't have been nearly as good because you don't have those skills innately. Whereas you just find someone who's like stunt people and actual fighters to just come in, and you don't need them to carry a movie. So they don't need to be some amazing actor. They just need to get through their bits.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent. Well, cool. I think we've done a deep enough dive. I've dragged out my Mission Impossible segment as long as I possibly can.
No, that was cool.
Yeah, I could talk about it forever. So thank you very much for coming back and doing this with me.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
In the meantime, where can people find you online?
So I host a podcast called Flawless, a music podcast. So each episode we talk about an album that one of the hosts or a guest thinks is flawless, and we find out all about it and why they love it. So Flawless, a music podcast. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If you just Google that, you will find us. We're on all the major podcasting services as well.
Yep, and I was on it twice.
Yes, you were on nominated 2 albums, which was great.
Damn straight. Excellent. As per usual, you can find me on Tom Cruise Reviews on Instagram, Tom Cruise Review, no S on Twitter, or my website, tomcruisereviews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.